Hello, everybody, and welcome to our 13th ever live Q&A. Tonight, I'm joined by the amazing Dr. Karen Hammond, who is an amazing nurse doing some cool things, and I'll get to an intro in a second. If you guys haven't watched the Nurse Break Live Q&A before, just make sure to tag a friend and share it so they can watch live tonight. And also make sure in the comments below, if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, just to type your questions for Karen. Anything related to disaster nursing, humanitarian nursing, ED nursing, leadership, sort of all those type of questions, you can shoot a message in the comments and I can ask her live. Also post where you guys are from. Are you interested in disaster nursing? Have you done some study in that area before? We're also live in Melbourne and there's crazy storms at the moment. So if for some crazy reason I disappear a screen or we have some technical difficulties, I am sorry. So just before I start, tonight's Nurse Break Live Q&A is sponsored by Nurse and Midwife Support. This is a national 24/7 support service for nurses, midwives, and students. The service is anonymous, confidential, and free. Support is provided by nurses and midwives who understand the world you live in and work in. And you can contact Nurse and Midwife Support for any issue you need support for, no matter where you are in Australia, 1-800-667-877, www.nmsupport.org.au. Your health matters. And Karen, thank you for joining me tonight.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. You are joining us from quarantine. Am I not incorrect?
Yes, quarantine.
How's that?
I'm smiling, but I don't really feel like smiling.
What day are you up to now?
Day four. I feel like every day is Groundhog Day at the moment.
Yeah, right. Ever done quarantine before or is this the first time?
So I did it when I went to Papua New Guinea, but I only did it for 7 days. I had a nice sweet room and I had a balcony, so I had fresh air. Yeah. So it's very different to this. This is one room, no fresh air. I feel very claustrophobic.
No. That's not good. No, I'll do a quick intro of you. Yeah, no, that's not good. Fresh air would be very therapeutic. That's a long time to have no fresh air. So Karen Hammond has just returned from Papua New Guinea, actually, after consulting for the World Health Organization on the spread of COVID-19 in PNG. So tonight we're going to be talking about disaster nursing. Karen is also a fellow of the College of Emergency Nursing Australasia, is a senior lecturer, a researcher, and is passionate about preparing individuals and health services for disasters and mitigating the sort of outcomes of that. So yeah, Karen, so besides being in quarantine and having no fresh air, let's get into it. So what was your journey into nursing like?
So my journey into nursing, very honestly and candidly, I didn't really want to be a nurse. It wasn't anything that I aspired to do. I really just wanted to travel the world. That was my plan. And my parents had filled out the SATAC or university acceptance form or whatever it is while I was living in Scotland. And I still remember the day that my father rang and said, "Oh, you've got into nursing." And I was disappointed. I didn't want to go to university. All I wanted to do was just travel the world. I was only 18 and I hadn't really thought ahead to what I was going to do. So it wasn't really a plan of mine. However, because I was only 18 and I'd sort of run out of money, I thought maybe I should come home and go to university and study nursing. So I did.
So you didn't enjoy nursing? You didn't even enjoy studying it or even your first few years as a nurse? You just weren't a fan?
No. I felt like...
Please elaborate.
I'm being very honest. I felt like university didn't really align to my real experiences as a nurse. And I remember the first year out of university, I felt that that's when I learned a lot of what I needed to know. And I was working on a ward, well, I was working on two wards during my graduate year. One was renal and one was orthopedics. And I just remember thinking, this isn't for me. And I don't know why. It just wasn't really for me. So I went down to the emergency department because that looked pretty cool, and spoke to the nurse manager down there and asked, is there any possibility that I could maybe come and work in the emergency department for a while? And she said, all right, we'll put you on a 3-month contract. And so that was it. I never looked back. I loved emergency nursing. I felt like I found my place. And I think maybe it was just this, you know, previously, like maybe ward nursing just wasn't really for me.
Yeah.
Maybe something you can relate to as an emergency nurse as well.
I actually really enjoyed working on Gen Med, to my own surprise. I think emergency nursing, a lot of a good majority of the patients are Gen Med patients. So I feel like Gen Med nursing is actually almost emergency nursing in itself. It's just you know what's going to come through the door rather than you don't. But the patients are pretty much the same. That was my experience anyway. So you're a fellow of the College of Emergency Nursing Australia. What is a fellow?
So a fellow is somebody who's got a lot of experience in emergency nursing or who has given a lot to emergency nursing or to the College of Emergency Nursing. So I've been a fellow since in the group of inaugural fellows, and I continue to be a member and a fellow of the college, and try to participate where I can. In the past, I was the president for our state branch, and I was on the college board. So previously I was very, very involved with the college, and over the last few years, I guess my career has diverted a little bit to disaster response and a little bit less around emergency nursing.
Right. Do you still identify as a emergency nurse?
Yeah. I mean, I've been an emergency nurse since 1997, and even when I've had other roles such as working at the university or when I've been in Adelaide, where I come from, I often will work in the emergency department and do shifts. And even at the university, I would do shifts on the weekend just to work in the emergency department. So I'm an emergency nurse at heart. I'm very passionate about emergency nursing, and I'm very passionate about preparing emergency nurses. Yes, very much an emergency nurse.
Cool. So I'm curious, so you've got into disaster, you're sort of a very senior lecturer in the field of disaster response and preparation. So, and you even run your own business, which we'll get to a bit later on to that, but why was 9/11, I've listened to a few podcasts you've done, read some of your work, why was 9/11 a catalyst for you to get into disaster nursing?
I think just the complete shock. I think back then, we hadn't really seen any, like on the TV, you might see bushfires or floods and things like that, but we hadn't seen anything to that, you know, of that extent probably in a country that has maybe a similar health system. And we had it was 24-hour coverage. It was in our face the whole time. And I just remember watching it. Someone told me to turn the TV on and I did. And so I saw it. It was unfolding. And I just remember thinking, first of all, I started thinking about, oh my gosh, where are those people? They're all going to go to the local or the nearest emergency department. Then I started thinking, oh, what about all the emergency department staff and how horrifying it must be for them? Then I started thinking, oh my gosh, what if something like this happened where I come from? I would have no idea what to do. I never had any disaster training. I didn't know there was a disaster plan. So I just felt, you know, like this is something that I wanted to know more about. And I started having conversations with my colleagues, because I felt really unprepared. Does that mean everyone else feels unprepared? And I think the more I spoke about it to my colleagues, everybody sort of felt the same way. So yeah, that then made me start to really think about the sort of the training that we've had or haven't had. And I did a little bit of a survey amongst emergency nurses in South Australia at the time, or in Adelaide, in the different emergency departments, just to find out, I guess, if everybody else felt the same way, what sort of disaster training had we had, and what sort of experience had we had. And I mean, we in Australia, we haven't really had experiences like mass casualty events to that extent, obviously.
So what were your findings? So what was the training? In, I mean, I don't think I got any training. No.
Yes. So, I mean, this was back in, by the time I did that research, I think it was published in 2008. It took a little while for that to all to happen. But, yes, people felt unprepared and they felt that they hadn't had enough training or experience to prepare them. So that was the catalyst, I guess, for then me going on and doing further study and doing a PhD and things like that, because I just became, like, I read everything that I could. I was just so passionate about knowing more and trying to understand what I could do if I was in that situation. Because literally in all of my university, we had never talked about disaster response. In my, I think I'd worked in three emergency departments at that time, and no one had said to me, oh, there's a disaster plan you should read. I didn't even know that such a thing existed. And we had never done any training. And then after that, I think most of the training that I had was training that I had gone and sought myself, or, you know, an in-service lecture here or there by somebody who was interested, or somebody who had deployed overseas or something like that.
Yeah, right. And do you think it's changed now? Do you think... at least for staff on the front line, at the very start of the hospital in ED, do you think it's better now, or don't think there's many changes?
Oh, I like to hope that I like to think that it has. I think it has. I think obviously with COVID, like, the whole world is a lot more aware of these sort of things. I think there's, you know, there's been a groundswell. There's a lot more people interested in disaster response. We've got teams that are, you know, deploying overseas to respond to disasters. So I think it's definitely, you know, yeah, there's a lot more interest. And I think perhaps there's more in-services and things like that happening, but I don't know how much. More awareness, but I don't know how much actual training opportunities there are for nurses working. I mean, working in the emergency department, or working as a nurse anyway, we're just so busy with the day-to-day. It's very hard to find time to go off and do training, especially with something that might not happen in your career.
Jason has just commented saying, yes, he's currently with Disaster Relief Australia looking at applying for OSMAT. And Ellen has said, yes, I'm a nursing student at the moment and completely unsure of where to look for opportunities to help with disaster response. We can maybe get onto that a bit later, Ellen. And Ashley, thanks for commenting. Good question. Oh, good statement. I would love to work in disaster relief, but after a bit of experience and toughening up, yes, probably a bit of experience. Thank you guys for commenting. Keep commenting with your questions as well. So you did some research. I have a quick little read before. In South Australia's disastrous power blackout in 2016. I do remember that. Do you want to sort of talk about your research with that? And then I guess we'll get on to where you've just come from, Papua New Guinea, because that's some pretty recent cool stuff you've been involved in.
Sure. So actually that day I was working, so I was working as an academic, but this is one of the extra shifts I was doing in the emergency department. And it was an afternoon shift. I think it must have been around 3 o'clock, because I remember everything flickered, like the lights sort of flickered and then they went off momentarily, and then sort of the backup generator or whatever kicked in. And I remember, so the reason it happened is because we had some mini tornadoes in the state that knocked out the power supply, and essentially we had a statewide power outage that lasted for quite a few hours. And then in the more rural and remote areas, it lasted I can't remember because this is a little while ago, but I think it was for more than a day in some of the more remote areas. And I think a lot of the emergency departments, they are near the front of the hospital, so you do often get the light from the front of the hospital, or where the ambulance entrance is or whatever. But as you go deeper into the emergency department, it's actually quite dark. So I think for me, though, in that experience, just challenging for me that with my children were coming home from school and their mobile systems went down as well, and I had no way of contacting them. So I didn't know if they were safe. But at the same time, we had an emergency department full of people to look after. So
was the backup plan, did it work? Like the generator? Like, was that a sufficient solution? Or?
The generators did kick in, but I know that one of the hospitals, the generator didn't kick in. And I know for people that were ventilated, I think in the ICUs that you know, obviously they had to hand ventilate people. So that research that we did, there was a few of us that were had been working that day and we'd been talking about it and, you know, all had similar experiences and wanted to know a little bit more about how it felt. So, yes, we did a survey to find about amongst emergency nurses and doctors just to find out what that experience was like, really.
Mm. There you go. I can't remember that entirely. I do vaguely remember that occurring. You're in quarantine. You've just come from PNG. So you were part of the incident management team for the World Health Organization in Papua New Guinea as a consultant. So what have you just been up to recently?
So my role was within the incident management team, we have different pillars. So you might have logistics, you might have surveillance, laboratory, and then we have case management, among other pillars. So I was leading the case management team, which is clinical management and infection prevention and control. Mm. So I had a small team underneath me of consultants from the World Health Organization, and we worked in the National Control Center with counterparts from the Department of Health in Papua New Guinea. So I had a clinical management and also infection prevention and control counterparts. And a lot of what we did was writing guidelines and SOPs and policies and things like that, but also doing a lot of training and going out to different provinces and having a look at the responses in the different provincial health authorities and talking to clinicians and providing technical advice as required.
So how is the system there set up? So do they have individuals with your level of expertise in country, or do they really, they do require sort of external expertise in your case?
Yeah, they have very well qualified people in Papua New Guinea. But then they also, particularly in a response that this is big, they do require support from other partner organisations. So World Health Organization was just one partner organisation. There were other organisations such as UNICEF or FHI 360 in different parts of the response, not just clinical, but, you know, the parts of the response, all working together to support Papua New Guinea.
So you sort of mentioned on the typical day your SOPs and your policy writing. What were some sort of other things that you'd wake up? Would you go to an office? Like, how does it work?
Yes. So if I was in Port Moresby, that's where I've been living for the last 9 months. So living in Port Moresby, I would go to work at the National Control Centre. And we all work in a big sort of open plan office together. That would be sort of my day-to-day would be spent in there attending meetings or writing documents or, and working with my colleagues. And then every now and then I'd go out on provincial travel. So that just means going out to a province and visiting the provincial health authority, who's like the local sort of the local Department of Health,
that's,
I guess.
In charge,
yeah. And then also going to the provincial hospital and sort of looking at their clinical pathways from as the patient arrives, their triage and screening and things like that, as well as their isolation or their COVID management. And also looking at it from an IPC perspective, to see how they're going. Often I would go with a team of other colleagues from the Department of Health or from the WHO. It would be mixed teams. So everybody in a team had sort of a different area of expertise. So I might have a surveillance person on the team or a logistics person on the team. So we're all going to provide support and often do some ad hoc training, go out to the district hospitals as well if we can, if they're not too far away, and provide as much technical support as we can. And then that helps build sort of relationships and networks. When you come back to Port Moresby, if we create a new guideline or whatever, we can always feed that back to them and try and provide some ongoing support.
And okay, and what would you say would be some of the biggest challenges you experience? I guess for me, like I'm assuming I haven't been to PNG, but do most people there speak English? So just language as one sort of challenge compared to all the other ones?
Yeah, so English is one of the official languages, as well as Tokpisin, which is one of the local languages. But PNG has about, I think it's over 800 cultures, and therefore different languages, different tribes have different languages, and there's just so many different languages in PNG. But most people, or pretty much everyone, speaks English. I did learn Tokpisin, very small amount of Tokpisin, just to, because I feel like it's nice to try and understand the language and be able to speak to the local people. And I think particularly when you go out of Port Moresby into the provinces, where people are more likely to be speaking their other local languages, it's just nice to be able to try and speak their language.
So how do you say wash your hands in Tokpisin? No.
I think it's was hands or something like that.
What would you say would be like the three, or maybe less, like the two biggest highlights? Like what was something that was like, that's a big achievement I did there, like you did make an impact, and maybe what was just another highlight you had?
I don't feel like I did anything by myself, so to speak. I think I was always working in a team. So I either had my sort of my case management team or the WHO broader team or the team that works at the NCC or the team that went out on provincial travel. So I felt like everything I did was part of a team, and it was very much a collaborative effort. Things that my team did that I think are useful is, you know, we reviewed their clinical management guidelines for COVID and their infection control guidelines. And we wrote guidelines on home isolation, as well as setting up an isolation facility at a hospital. So these were quite big guidelines that I think will be very useful. But I think maybe for me it's the little interactions I've had along the way with different healthcare workers that maybe have a bigger impact in the long run, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. And were there many Australians in PNG with you, or?
Oh, there's lots. It's everywhere. Like Australia in a way. There were a lot of Australians there. In our WHO team, we had a few, but definitely there was a big expatriate Australian population there.
I'm curious, so how do you get a job with WHO? Like, do they poach you, or do you have sort of relationship with them previously, or do you just go to a website and apply?
So I've been working for the WHO for a couple of years now. I think my first opportunity with the WHO came up through connections, and that they had a need, and I was at the right point in my career to be available for that need. But the other two, the next opportunity came up, they have an emergency roster which you can apply to. And if you've got the right experience, I think it goes all into a data system, and your name might come up if you're appropriate for the particular job that they need. They also, advertise their jobs as well. But I think as you get into the system and you get to know people, you do find out about different job opportunities that are out there?
I think a lot of people got the question. There's a few people commenting, but I think a common question is, what sort of training do, we'll get to some more questions, but what sort of training do I need, or what career path do I choose to get into these sort of careers where you can make sort of an impact on your level? Do you have to do ED nursing and have a crit care background? And do you have to do a PhD and a doctorate such as yourself? What do you think would be like at least the minimum sort of things required?
I think it depends on what you want to do. So, I mean, obviously I'm not working as a nurse in these roles. My nursing background certainly helps me, I think. But I'm not employed as a nurse. I'm employed as a consultant. And I think the way that I've got there is by simply pursuing a passion and doing a PhD, I guess, in this area. I think if you want to work, you know, operationally as a nurse in development, then there are a lot of organisations and NGOs that you can seek further training with. But I think having a background in emergency or, you know, areas that are valuable, you know, remote and rural nursing, because a lot of these countries that you'll be deployed to are very low resourced settings. And I think even for me, I just have found working, you know, I've always had everything at hand working in the emergency department. Everything's there. Everything's so well resourced. We have everything we need. And then you go out to these little, you know, clinics and facilities, or even some of the provincial hospitals, and they don't have running water, or they don't have a, you know, regular supply, electricity supply, or they can't have a stethoscope to listen to someone's chest. Simple things that we just have in abundance. I think being able to work in those low resource settings, I think would really stand you in good stead. And obviously having a good clinical knowledge, if you're going to do that sort of working as an actual nurse in those situations. I think if you want to do the sort of work that I do, pursuing maybe, you know, further studies in public health or development would be really beneficial as well.
I think that's very, very good advice. Hopefully that helped to anyone who's wondering. I guess we've got a few comments. So Karen said, Lou said, hi, Karen. I recently left Qantas and I'm nursing in training. I'm an EN and where do I start my journey to get into this field? So hopefully Lou, Karen sort of provided you some wisdom there. Laureen says, what have you found to be the most valuable skills to have in your role, and how did you develop those skills throughout your career?
I sort of think being an emergency nurse has helped me in that I feel like I'm quite pragmatic and but can adapt quite quickly to different situations. So I, you know, I do think that's general, and also being able to cope with different stressful situations that, you know, are thrown at you in the emergency department. So I think a lot of that experience as an emergency nurse has really helped me through my career. I think the way I got where I was literally just being passionate about something. I mean, doing a PhD was also not in the plan at all. I very much loved emergency nursing. I was a senior nurse in the emergency department. I saw myself as, you know, being an emergency nurse forever. And when I did that little study that we talked about previously, someone else mentioned to me that I should go and find this man who he's doing something similar, they told me. And I got the research that I did was accepted for a conference in Amsterdam. And while I was there, he was presenting, and I remembered that person said to me, oh, he's doing the same stuff. So I went and had a chat to him after he did his presentation, and he tried to convince me then, oh, you should do a PhD. I remember thinking, I'm a clinician, like, why would I do that? Okay. So anyway, he ended up being my PhD supervisor. I actually went and did an honours degree because I think it was about 15 years since I'd finished nursing. So I did my honours degree, and then just this passion kept driving me to want to know more and to better prepare people. And so then I did go and pursue the PhD, which people that I went to school with would think hilarious because I'm not the most studious person.
Yeah, someone who hated nursing did a PhD in it. There you go.
You know, well, no, okay, so I didn't want to be a nurse, but I don't hate nursing. I'm a proud nurse, and I think it's an you know, a fantastic career. I think being a nurse can take you to so many different places and give you so many amazing experiences. And I'm actually thankful that my parents did sort of push me in that direction because I've had an amazing career, and I would recommend nursing to anyone. Like, I do think it's a really great job. It's just that I didn't think it was something I wanted to pursue back then. I didn't think a PhD was what I wanted to pursue either, and then here I am.
Yeah, and I think many students, and, you know, that first year when you had those feelings, I think that's quite a common, you know, feeling for many people. It's almost like it's a mixture of what am I doing plus imposter syndrome plus I've made a big mistake. But if you push through, then you find out you can, you know, do some cool things in your career. I think that's sort of one of the cool things I've been able to get through the nurse break to people, is that there's lots of sort of opportunities out there if you just push through it. My next question is, you actually developed a whole master's degree. Now, I don't feel like that many people get to do that. So you've developed a whole master's degree in disaster health. Yeah. What's the story behind that?
Okay. So again, it wasn't just me. So I was working at the university, and the university had an interest in developing a disaster program. And I guess with my background, I seemed like a likely choice to drive that. So I worked a lot with the National Critical Care Trauma Response Centre up in Darwin with the staff up there at the time, as well as different academics. And we created a nine topic master's degree. So using everybody's expertise, I guess, we devised sort of a plan for what that would look like, and created the content. And then I ran the course also with help from other people running some of the topics and doing some of the sessions. But it was a course for nurses, doctors, paramedics, other allied health who either were interested in disaster response because maybe they work in an area that they know that there's a disaster, or there might be a disaster and they want to be prepared for it, or maybe they want to deploy in a humanitarian sense. So it was very much an operational course, and master's by coursework, not master's by research.
Yeah, right. I'm curious. So there's many types of disasters. You know, you've got the pandemic, and then you've got CBRNs, chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and then you've got natural disasters and so on. So we've had a few comments that Amy has commented, but how do the courses structure around different types of disasters, or is it just a sort of generalized degree?
It did address the fact that there is lots of different types of disasters and they have very different impacts. There was courses specific to humanitarian response and like large sudden onset or catastrophic disasters, as well as some content on things like pandemics and things like that. So, there was quite a variation. And I have to point out, like, when I left the university, that course stopped running, unfortunately.
Which university was it?
That was the university where I was working at that time.
Sorry, I cut you out. What was it? Which university?
Flinders University in South Australia, which is where I was working at the time. But I know there's other sort of tertiary level disaster courses out there still, master's degrees, I think, through Edith Cowan University and through Monash University that people could pursue.
Yeah, Amy Smith's just commented saying, I'm currently studying and I've been doing a master's in public health while working in DEM. I'm not sure what DEM is, for the last year. I'm also looking at the Masters in Disaster and Emergency Management at CDU. Did you have any input on this course?
Oh, they're all probably great.
Do it, Amy.
I mean, I would say do it. If this is an area that you're interested in, do it. Having that qualification and that theoretical knowledge behind you will certainly help.
Cool. Where do you envision disaster health or nursing education in 10 years? Or what do you want to see?
Oh, what I would love to see is that all undergraduate courses for clinicians, so not just nurses but doctors as well, have disaster content, and that, you know, and then tertiary level courses, particularly for frontline nurses and doctors, have disaster content, and that hospitals provide disaster training for clinicians on a regular basis, not just every now and then, or we've just had a cyclone, so we better do some disaster training, like something that's regular that helps keep people disaster aware and feeling like they can respond. At the end of the day, unless you're going to deploy somewhere specific, what you do in a disaster is more or less what you're going to do on a daily basis anyway. So you need to just know what you know. Is not, you don't, you know, you need to understand the broad context that you're working within, and the fact that, you know, you might not be able to save everybody, particularly if you've got a mass casualty situation, but you're going to be asked to do what you usually do. You just might see some traumatic things, and that's what we should be preparing for, because it's the post-traumatic stress that happens after these events that we're not well prepared for, or we don't address.
Do you have researchers or colleagues in Italy and those countries that have, and Brazil and so on, who have been completely decimated by COVID? You know, they had to get to the point where they're doing reverse triage. Do you have colleagues, or is there much research in?
I think amount of research, and we already have. We've seen a lot of research coming out of because of COVID-19, but definitely as people catch up and find time to write, I guess, and publish, then we'll definitely be seeing a lot more about people's experiences with COVID-19. But yes, definitely you've had colleagues that have had to work in some incredibly confronting situations because of COVID.
Yeah. Joel has said, I'm 41, decided to do nursing. He's in his third year, but he's got a young family. I didn't even know this was an avenue of nursing that was offered. This really places a spanner in my decision over the next year.
And I think also, I mean, obviously my children are grown up now, but when I had this interest, they were quite young, and it's hard. I mean, I've been away for 9 months. That's also hard. But it's hard to pursue some of this because it does require you to be away from home if you're going to deploy. There's two aspects. If you're going to deploy for humanitarian or development purposes, or if you are just in a situation where there's a disaster at home and you need to respond. The other thing that people can think about if they've got time is to get involved in, you know, organisations like Red Cross at home, because they're often responding to disasters and need that support to set up evacuation centres and things like that. So you might not be working as a nurse, but you're still gaining experience and an understanding of what it's like to work in those situations.
Yeah, I think top of my head, Red Cross, St. John Ambulance, the SES, CFA, yeah.
Yeah, and then they offer you training that's very relevant that you're not necessarily going to be getting in your hospital employment, and, you know, very worthwhile experiences, and then you're working towards a good cause as well and supporting a NGO.
Yeah, no, totally. Now, I probably should have asked this question earlier on, but I guess I want you to differentiate between sort of the different aspects of disasters. So you have the preparedness stage, which you do a lot of focus on, but then you also have the response stage and the recovery stage. And then before even preparedness, you have the mitigation stage. Is that correct? Or have I mixed them up?
Yeah. So, well, it depends. There's different models, and the PPR model is one, but yes. I mean, even if you think about it in those three phases, like the before, the during, and the after, for example. And so nurses can play a huge role in the, if we, you know, looking at preparedness, in helping to devise disaster plans, pushing for their employers to actually practice the disaster plans. It's all good and well having a plan sitting in a cupboard somewhere, which is what happened in the earlier parts of my career, but you need to practice it. And you need to, you know, that plan needs to be updated. If the hospital changes or staffing ratios change or whatever, that plan needs to be updated. That's my dinner being delivered.
you can pause if you like.
No, it's okay. So, yeah, so nurses can play a really big role in the sort of preparedness phases, doing things like that. And then during response, nurses are the biggest healthcare group, clinical group, and therefore obviously always going to be involved in disaster response. And therefore I feel they should be prepared in it. They should be prepared to understand the context that they're working in and have an awareness of what it's like, and prepared for the potential post-traumatic factors that might come out. Then obviously there's things like the burden on the healthcare system. So if with COVID, what we've seen in a lot of countries that have become overwhelmed is the hospitals start to shut down their essential service, or so they only have essential services running. And things like outpatient clinics might be closed down for some time. So people are not getting the usual medications or the usual treatment that they would get, which might lead to a higher burden on the health system because, for example, they've not been managing their chronic conditions. So things like that, that nurses obviously will play a huge part in as well.
No, I think that's a really important point. I feel like a lot of nurses, especially in Victoria, would be experiencing that with such a long lockdown, and seeing the spike of acute on chronic sort of issues that are presenting. You sort of talk about another interview you've done about read the plan, that sort of concept of how do we better prepare, and that's read the plan and then go from there. So can you sort of elaborate on that?
So what I would say to anybody who starts a new job as a nurse, for example, or a clinician, is go and find out what the plan is first of all in your local area. Like, so let's say you're an emergency nurse and, you know, in your first few days you should know, where is the emergency department plan for disaster? Well, how does that fit into the bigger picture? So how would the hospital be involved in a disaster response? Or how does your state respond to a disaster? And then what is your role within all of that? What would you be expected to do? And you're not going to be expected to go and do, you know, if it's your first day on the job, you're not going to be expected to be out in the front running triage and managing, you know, prioritisation of all those casualties. You're going to be doing what you're supposed to be doing, which is being a nurse who works in the emergency department. But you need to know the plan. And I think it's, you know, there could be a plan there. It could be sitting in a cupboard somewhere. And read it, you know, critically. So does the plan make sense? Is it easy to understand? Can it actually be implemented? And if not, then there needs to be a push to the employers to update the plan and also practice the plan. One of the best things that I did, I didn't do, but in my career, we had some other clinicians who were very interested in disaster response, and we were building a new emergency department, and they did like a simulation. So we had the old emergency department still staffed, and then we staffed a new emergency department. So a group of us were on duty this particular day, and they had a big chemical event, explosion somewhere nearby, and they had hired all these, I don't know, medical students and SES volunteers to be victims and to react in however they would in that situation. So we had to run the emergency department with these live casualties and really test the new emergency department and the new disaster plan. And it was one of the biggest simulations that they'd had at that time in the Southern Hemisphere. So for me, that was one of my first exposures to working in that sort of environment. And I think it was amazing. It really gave me that knowledge and experience that we don't normally get in a controlled sort of environment. However, it's obviously very labour intensive and not very cost effective to do. But I think whenever we do things like that, where we build a new emergency department, I think is a good opportunity to perhaps do things like that.
Yeah, right. And I guess sort of leading on from that is, what would you say are some of the barriers or red tape that sort of exist that you'd like to see removed?
I think in hospitals, there's so many things that we have to be prepared for. Like, obviously we need to know our basic life support or our advanced life support and things like that, things that are more likely to happen more frequently. But those are like more frequent, but they're lower consequence, whereas a disaster has very high consequences, and that's why we need to be prepared for it. But because they don't necessarily happen that often or have such extreme effects, you know, a bushfire out in the bush is not having major effects in the city, for example. It is for the local people in that area. And so then hospitals don't really factor in disaster planning or disaster training or preparedness. And I think it's something that I would just love to see involved or happen more often.
No, that makes sense. Now you've created a whole business out of this as well. What is Disaster Readiness Solutions?
It's a consultancy business, or we can do disaster training, or we can do sort of workshops and things like that, all around disaster response or preparing individuals on organisations for disasters. So obviously my interests lie very much with health professionals and preparing health professionals. Other things I am doing research and policy writing and things like that as well. So it's quite a new business, and I've been so busy with working. I mean, in the last, 16 months, I've been working on the COVID response, not only in PNG, but previously for WHO in Copenhagen, and also in Adelaide for a group of hospitals there. So my business put aside, basically.
Yeah, right. What's the website?
Disaster Readiness Solutions, probably www. somewhere.
If you have an interest in that, or you're a senior nurse and you need some help, then check out that. I'm curious, what is your leadership style, and what would your advice be for up and coming nurse leaders?
I don't think I've analyzed my leadership style too much, but I like to try and be inclusive and listen. Like, I feel like everybody comes with different experiences, and I'm not the font of all knowledge. Like, everybody brings different experiences and different knowledges, different levels of knowledge. And you can have preconceived ideas about what that person brings, but I think you need to be open to what they can bring and hear them out. So I think I try to be inclusive and understanding, I guess, to other people's experiences and collaborative.
Yeah, nice. And in your 25-year nursing career, so I was one when you started. Sorry.
Very old.
What is the key to a successful nursing career?
I don't know because I think there are so many different avenues of nursing, as we touched on before, and I don't know. I think there's just so many different ways to measure a successful nurse, because you could be successful as a nurse, as I think we have good nurses and, you know, not so great nurses, people that are really passionate and people that go in and look at their patient and talk to their patient and see their patient as a person, not as, oh, I have to go and do a blood pressure in there or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that makes a really successful nurse, someone who's mastered that art and isn't just seeing nursing as a job. So to me, that's a successful nurse. And you could have someone who does that for, I don't know, 50 years and does it really well. That's a successful nurse. But then there's also all these other avenues of nursing. So I think it's about, you know, like, you could be in academia, or it could be in development, or some more policy writing and things like that. So I think somebody who gives back to their profession, and that's why, you know, doing research is good. If you can disseminate your research properly and help to make changes, I think that's, you know, also someone who does that, it can be quite successful. So I think there's just so many different ways of measuring a successful nurse.
No, I agree. It's a tricky question. And I mean, yeah, how do you measure that? No, that was a perfect answer. So if you could give yourself advice back in time to when you were a junior nurse, what would it be?
I don't know. I think just to take every opportunity. I think a lot of the things that have happened in my career, opportunities that have been presented to me, and I've had a sliding doors moment, I guess, where I could have gone, I'll take that road or I'll take that road. And sometimes I've just gone with the opportunity and it's opened up these amazing pathways for me. So I think taking opportunities when they come and keeping, you know, to always learn. I don't think you don't just do your nursing degree and you're done. I mean, obviously I went on and I did a emergency nursing diploma and then I did an honours and then I did a PhD. I didn't plan to do all that. But in between that, there's all the other learning that you should do, like your professional development and keeping up to date with the, you know, the latest ways of doing or latest treatments and things like that. Not on everything, but definitely specific to your area. So I think always being open to opportunities and to learning opportunities as well.
100%. I think lifelong learning. And for anyone who's watching, we're almost finished. If you have any final questions, make sure to type them in the comments. And everyone who's been listening to this as a podcast in the future to this, thank you for joining. My last two questions is who have been your biggest mentors? And I guess who do you go for support?
Professionally, I guess my PhD supervisor, he was also my employer at one point. And I think he's obviously the person that convinced me that doing a PhD was a good idea. And I, you know, at a time when I just thought that was a crazy idea, I guess he had a different vision. And I think obviously I chose to listen to him. He's been a good support throughout my career, since then, guiding me and you know, providing me with different opportunities, I guess. He was also the person that put me into contact with the people at the WHO, so he led me down again, another path in my career. So I would say he's probably been my biggest mentor in a professional capacity.
I think having a mentor is really important. And one last question from the audience, actually, Wesley, who has been a guest of mine, actually, and he's an ED nurse. Was going from ED nursing into disaster management / response an easy transition? And what would you recommend for those who are curious about going down that route? And anything you haven't answered already, a few of those aspects have been touched on.
I think I didn't sort of make this really clear transition. I actually felt I got a little bit burnt out working in the emergency department. I was always at triage or always in the resuscitation room or shift coordinator in a big, busy urban ED, constantly being, you know, verbally abused and whatnot.
Yep.
And I did get a little bit burnt out and did also feel that I couldn't progress in my career because a lot of the people that were in leadership positions there had been in leadership positions there for a very long time. And it was very hard to get into a leadership position. So all this happened around the time that I was doing an honours degree and then the whole world of academia opened up to me. And so I actually made the transition into academia, which I found very, very different. Like being a nurse, you start shift at a certain time and you have, if you're lucky, half an hour break for your meal and you know, you leave it another time again if you're lucky. And it's very structured and, you know, whereas academia was a bit more autonomous, and I was always constantly waiting for someone to come and knock on my door and ask me what I'm doing and, you know, just very different way of working. And I did feel that transition was huge and I didn't know if I'd made the right decision. And as you know, I couldn't give up emergency nursing. I kept doing it on the weekends because I just really, that was my identity and that's what I knew. I think the work that I've been doing has been a bit more, you know, with the WHO after I left the university was around chemical and biological preparedness, and then it moved into the COVID response as well. And so a lot of it's been around writing policies and assessing hospitals for their preparedness. Not so much emergency management, I guess. It's more, I don't know. I feel like it's been a bit more developmental where I've been working. So I think, yeah, to me it was a bit more of a logical transition moving into that sort of stuff after a career in academia. I think I had the knowledge to be able to write policies and SOPs and guidelines and things like that and work at that more academic level. But I also have the clinical background to be able to go into health facilities and understand the flow and what sort of program management things should be in place. So I think academia and emergency has all brought me to this place, perhaps. This is me thinking as I'm talking to you.
And here we are.
Wesley, I'm sorry.
And, I think very senior nurse Lisa Kuhn.
Lisa.
Has Lisa written a book? I've got a feeling I've read her textbook.
Lisa's a very well-known emergency nurse.
Thanks to you both for tonight's presentation. Great to hear about your journey, Karen. So, yeah, thank you, Lisa, for your comments and for watching along. It's great to have junior and senior nurses tuning in. And I think having, you know, a live Q&A like this sort of breaks down some barriers and make it a bit more personable. So hopefully everyone has enjoyed. And hopefully this wasn't too nerve-wracking for you. I know this is the first time doing a live Q&A for yourself. So thank you for joining.
I hope it's been worthwhile for people. And, you know, I am available on LinkedIn if people have more questions.
Perfect. Once again, for everyone who was watching, thank you. Make sure to check out all our other live Q&As we've done. You can listen to them all. You can either watch them like on video right now, or you can listen to them as podcasts. All you have to do is just type in Google The Nurse Break and then just click on the live podcast videos. And you can watch all the other ones we've done. We've done some amazing, amazing topics. This is probably the last one we're going to do for a while. I'm moving to the Northern Territory, so it could be quite a few months before I am able to do another one of these, but rest assured we will do more. Lisa has said I am not, so yes you are. So thank you once again, guys, and keep in we've got a mini series on violence and a whole bunch of other questions coming out. The next trailer might come out tomorrow or not. And the plan is to get some media exposure and sort of bring to the forefront of everyone's attention sort of the shit that we do deal with across all aspects of nursing, community, aged care, mental health, ED. We deal with a lot of violence, sometimes intentional, sometimes not. So it's all about bringing attention to that. So just make sure to stay tuned, like the Facebook page, and subscribe, share, subscribe. And thank you, Karen, once again for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jackson. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I'll meet you offline at the back.
Okay.